Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of the Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community improvement the norm for social change efforts rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to welcome Sonia Campion as my guest on Making Change. After almost three decades as a fundraising consultant, in 2005, Sonia moved to the other side of the table when she and her husband Tom founded the Campion Foundation. Their intent in doing so was to move beyond simply writing checks and to instead catalyze real change in the areas of wilderness protection, ending homelessness, and building the capacity of the sector overall. Given her experience at both ends of the funding spectrum, and given the foundation's work both locally in Seattle and across the whole U.S., it is my pleasure to have Sonia Campion share her observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Sonia Campion. Welcome, Sonia. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, it's great to meet with you.
I start these podcasts off with the same question every time, and I'm really looking forward to exploring with you. When you see change, and you've had two hats in this profession, you know, almost, you know, probably three or four. When you look at all sides of your experience, what is it that's happening when change is really happening in communities? What are some of the factors that you see underpinning that change?
I had the privilege over about 20 years, I was a fundraising counsel for organizations undertaking capital campaigns, or I used to describe it when organizations are undertaking big, big change. And I really felt honored to be a part of their journey because it was usually a small board that realized that they needed to do more for the community, that their mission wasn't being satisfied. And, it, you know, as you know, campaigns from the twinkle in the eye to the ribbon cutting, that can be anywhere from 3 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's a long journey. And so I took a look as I was kind of closing down that phase of my life and looking back over all the different campaigns and the ones that were most successful. The ones that were where I thought big change happened, it all started with an individual action that then joined a collective. And along the journey, making sure that they checked in with the community and were still relevant. And I came to that only by looking at the campaigns that were hard or difficult or didn't reach their goal. And they were often started by a mega donor, which in mm-hmm. Seattle, Washington, we have a fair amount of those who, well-intentioned, would be over-generous to an organization, like offer $10 million of the first $100 million of the campaign. Well, that leaves $90 million left to go. And people couldn't find themselves in that campaign. So campaigns that were hard were ones that were started with too much of a major gesture where the community couldn't see how they would make a difference. And then they just were bullheaded, put their head down on the sand and kept going without really checking in with the community about if they were still important. So from the negative, I found the positive, which was those groups where one person stepped forward and said, we've got to make this happen. And my favorite was my first capital campaign. I was 28 years old and scared to death. I hadn't really done this. I joined a fellow who had a ma and pa shop consulting firm. He was absolutely brilliant, Stuart Grover. And he believed I could do anything. But we worked with the Macaw Indian tribe, which is out on the very, very northwest corner of the country. That's mm-hmm. Way out on the Olympic Peninsula here in the northwest. Very hard to get to. But they had an amazing collection of artifacts that had been uncovered by a mudslide, and it was Smithsonian caliber artifacts, and they needed to build a storage center to house them. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, an ambitious campaign to raise $2 million way out in the middle of the Olympic Peninsula. But it was just, it was a magical campaign, and it all got started when we were hemming and hawing, you know, how do we get going here? Most of the sources were probably going to be national foundations and such. But finally, an elder stepped forward, and he made the first pledge. And it was $100 over 10 years. He signed a pledge form. And God bless him, he had never signed a charitable pledge form to give that much money. And God bless him, he lived to pay that pledge off. But that's what got going. And That's what got the campaign going. The next thing, the Smithsonian came in and the National Endowment and such. But also along the way, they checked in with the community, and I mean, they kept making sure that the community understood the relevance, that this wasn't just a warehouse to preserve stuff. It was about keeping their culture alive and keeping their native language alive. And it was a very real and vibrant journey. And one funny thing, I'll quit after this. But
oh, don't quit. Keep going.
Well, this same elder, he was on the board and such. And I remember about 2 years into the campaign or so, he called me and he said, it was probably about now, springtime in May, and when the roads open up, it's easier to get there. And I was diligently working in Seattle, and I had a slew of foundations lined up to come out to visit, to site visit. And, you know, National Endowment for Humanities, Kresge, all kinds of people were slated. And he said, oh, Sonia, I just called to say we need to stop the campaign for a while. And I couldn't say anything. And I said, well, why? And he goes, well, we need to take care of our people. There's some things happening, and there's some things that are going to happen. We just need to take care of our people for a while.
Wow.
I said, okay, thinking about all these arrangements. And I knew that it was non-negotiable. I didn't know. I knew it wasn't open for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, when could we restart? And he said, when would you like it to restart? And I said, well, how about September 15th? Because he said they needed the summer, and it's fishing season, and a lot of things happen then. He said, sure, whatever you want. September 15th, fine. But no action, no nothing for 4 months. Well, sure enough, September 15th comes along, and what happens? Somebody's wandering through their museum, a tourist, is so touched that he gives a check of $5,000 that day. Just gives it. And I was blown away. And the elder said, well, Sonia, you said today's the restart of the campaign, so of course this would happen.
Oh.
So a touch of magic is always important for transformation, too.
Absolutely. Well, have you seen that consistent as you've gone from fundraiser into funder?
Well, that's an interesting transition. Funders, very interesting on this side of the pond, because I almost feel like there's more here on this side of the pond. There's everything the nonprofit sector wishes. There's money, unlimited amounts of money. But I actually find there's less hope and vision on the foundation side than there is on the nonprofit side.
Wow.
And I think it's because, you know, we're in land of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, an extraordinary vision.
Sure.
And such. But I think it's because we have less control on the foundation side. On the nonprofit side, you can set a strategic plan and a mission and go forward to that, whereas on the foundation side, you need people, unless you're an operating foundation,
mm-hmm.
but you need to work with a variety of intermediaries to make it happen. And so the control issue and the ownership issue gets a little muddled.
Yeah, you're more of a catalyst than actually getting the work done on the ground.
Right.
Do you notice, and I know that you guys have only been a foundation for a small number of years, but you mentioned, you know, early on here that it's when folks are checking in with the community to make sure that they're still relevant. Are you noticing the difference in some of the folks that you're funding, those that are checking in with the community versus those that are not? Are you seeing any difference between them?
You know, the focus of our foundation is about 75% of it is wilderness, preserving the largest remaining wilderness left. And because of that, when you think about that, we actually naturally ended up in the Arctic and ended up in Alaska, because that is some of the largest land left. And then we also focus, and they're not really related, but they are somewhat related. We also focus on homelessness and advocacy. We did that because we didn't want to be 100% environmental, because we wanted to stay in touch with our fellow man and neighbors and what's happening. But also we thought the two would kind of inform each other, too. And what we're noticing with the Arctic and Alaska is when we do expand across the country and get out of just working on the Hill, which to say that quite honestly is going to happen on Capitol Hill in D.C. It's a federal legislation is going to happen. However, to build the political will and the support, and when we spread out over the country, we're tapping into vision and hope that people have for our lands, and that they can understand public lands. They might not understand all the federal legislation it takes. Look, they just need to put pressure on their electives that these lands are sacred and they want a country that has them. So I'm seeing much more energy and hopefulness and movement on that sector because we've started to expand and involve more people. For example, we just funded an IMAX movie called To the Arctic. It's opening up right now, actually.
Wow.
And all the IMAX movies all over the country. It's basically to tell the story of the Arctic, not only America's Arctic, but the circumpolar Arctic and the role and the lives of polar bears and the role of global warming in that, and that it's important. It's more of a global warming, but also to save the habitat of the species up there. And it's touching a chord in people where they're going once and then they're going back and they're bringing their families and then they're bringing their friends of their kids and then they're bringing their crosses. Because I think it touches a magical place in us that we know we need, even if we're never going to see it. So I'm hopeful. I think the environmental movement's kind of getting a boost of energy because of how motivated people are. Not just this movie, but in general, tapping into that.
You know, it's really interesting. You're really talking about the same emotional cord that I felt when you spoke about the tribal elder and him giving $100 over 10 years, the emotional chord that obviously must have struck with his community. You're really talking about something that's more than just checking in with the community. You're really talking about this sort of, you know, having skin in the game sort of thing. When you're talking about the IMAX movie and you're talking about people bringing more and more people, it's obviously they've got emotional skin in the game. It's that connection. You know, we always think of having some skin in the game. We always think of that in terms of the stuff we have. I've given my money. But you're really talking about something a little bit deeper than that. You're really talking about having your emotions in the game.
Yes, we are. But at the same time, those emotions have got to translate into your political behavior, too. Are they paying attention to the real levers of our democracy that will make a permanent difference? People have to then realize it matters who you elect to office. You know, pay attention to their issues.
I'm wondering how one catalyzes that. I mean, catalyzing really is activating the potential of others. Talked about that through the fact that you're no longer on the ground, that funders are catalysts. I'm wondering how one catalyzes, activates the potential of others to be politically active. How does one get folks to act? What are you finding, especially with all of the work that you're doing on the Hill with the Arctic wilderness?
Well, there's also you know, another example of activating the potential of others. I like that because actually that's really how I ran capital campaigns too.
Mm-hmm.
They were about building community and having as many different community sectors come together as possible. My favorite campaign was an art museum campaign, but it had 13 different subcommittees. It almost killed the staff. But it was everything from the little old ladies that founded the museum to the high-tech moguls that were offices were going to be near there, and the arts patrons who were looking forward to that, you know, international arts caliber. And every single one of them almost had a different case statement.
Wow.
Because the museum meant something different to them.
Sure.
And they each had a different goal. The little old ladies had a $50,000 goal, and the high-tech moguls had a $4 million goal. But they all sat at the table and held each other accountable, and the case got richer and richer and richer as they would share how they were telling the story in the community. Because they all had different takes on it, which is how a vibrant nonprofit should be of value to a community. Everyone should kind of see it in a different light. But in terms of activating political momentum, on our homelessness side of our foundation, we took a look at the reason we got into advocacy is we're all about leveraging our dollars, and we just couldn't go into direct support around homelessness, or we could write a check on January 1st and be done. And
right.
Not really move the dial.
Right.
Took a look at going up the food chain and around the advocacy needed, because a public-private partnership around homelessness and affordable housing it's essential.
Mm-hmm.
But very few people understand it. And the field, and I think you've talked about this in the past, the nonprofit sector, and especially around social services, has become more and more professionalized.
Mm-hmm.
So when I would go to Capitol Hill or to D.C. to lobby or even down to our own Capitol in Washington State, I looked around and I never saw any board members or any civic people. I only saw professional staff. And the good thing is I was quite impressed how the elected officials really appreciated them and really felt respected their expertise.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side is, where is the community in this? And so we took a look at, well, who would be the natural leaders that we would expect to be lobbying and to be advocating on our behalf, and it was board members.
Right.
And so we started a project called the Board Advocacy Project. In fact, you can find it at boardadvocacy.org. But we took a look at, just in Washington State, the homelessness and affordable housing sector has about 500 organizations, give or take, you know, on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And that means at least 5,000 to 10,000 board members. And I think the reason they're not mobilized is they really don't understand the role of public policy or the role of public dollars in their beloved organization.
Right.
And so we're trying to help that understanding, even on going kind of at the baseline of, I sat through a lot of board meetings as a consultant, and I rarely saw the ED give a financial report that also talked about the public sector dollars. It was usually about the private dollars and the next fundraiser and the next, you know, raffle tickets and such. And so trying to get EDs to present a budget that truly reflects both sides of the ledger and to give reports on the trends that are coming and that are affecting the organization, just to give knowledge first.
Right.
And then moving that into our ultimate vision is that advocacy would become a part of a board's fiscal responsibility, because it is. It's essential to the health of the organization.
Have you seen boards that have, or a board that you can talk about that has taken on that role of advocacy and what the results might have been?
Oh, yeah. You know, during our capital campaign time, there was always public dollars involved, and they were a little bit easier to focus on. They were very discrete funds, you know, funding agency and such. But when we would prepare board members to go talk to their electeds about this, you know, they'd come back with a $4 million win, which is a pretty big high. And they also, one board member, I remember he was in Spokane, Washington, and he said, he was just giddy. And I could tell it was more than just the money. It was, but $4 million out of a $30 million campaign was a huge leap. And he said, you know, it's more than that. I feel like I came out. And I didn't know where he was going with it. He goes, I feel like I came out with what's important to me and what my values are and what I stand for in this community by talking to our senator about this organization.
Wow.
And I was stunned. And I thought, he did.
Yeah.
I mean, he went on record. It's in the permanent record, his conversation with electeds about why this is important, and it felt great to him, as I think it does to anybody when they get really clear on their values and they act on them, and then it helped to have such a high return.
You know, it is really interesting that the return consistently in what we hear, both in the fundraising world and just overall, and in the stories that you've shared, is that the money's almost a side benefit of all the other stuff, that it really is when you engage people's hearts and minds and souls and their whole being, that they will share not just what they have, but really everything that they are. And that's what lights people on fire. That's what creates the change.
I heard your wonderful interview with Peter Block, and I loved about how transformation will change in communities when people really bring their gifts and focus on what they have to offer. And I'm seeing this now and working with our homelessness and affordable housing organizations. You know, a lot of them have very scrappy boards, and my God, they have been in the field for a long time.
Right.
And they feel a little bit, you know, they don't have the big community names on their board. And I try to reassure them that, first of all, there are no big community names anymore. You know, what people really look for are people who really have a passion and a gleam in their eye, and that this is important to them, and that's what an effective board is. When one board member said, you know, I really heard you. I was giving a talk about a month ago, and said, I really believe that. And I realized I didn't have the gleam in my eye, so I quit. I thought, the ED might not have been happy with that.
Well, and when there's a fit, it really is magical. And whether that's a fit with a board member in an organization or the fit of somebody, as I love the term, coming out, somebody coming out into what they really stand for in their community, when that passion is there, when that emotion is there, when that excitement is there, that's really what turns into advocacy. That's really what turns into change.
Right, right.
Well, Sonia, I am so glad that you could join us today and share your observations over that whole breadth of the spectrum of this sector's work. I hope that we can check in with you in the coming months and see how everything is going.
I'd love to. And thank you for your work on expanding our vision of the world.
Thank you.
Speaking with Sonia, I'm reminded of something we don't often get to reflect upon in this podcast. While guests here typically talk about the various factors that create change in communities, Sonia reminds us that deep commitment to the community is also the most critical factor in running all the internal operations of an organization. From her stories about fundraising to her stories about board members, when connection to the community is deep and clear, great things happen both inside organizations and out. I especially loved Sonia's story about the board member who is finally coming out to what is important to him. We're so frequently encouraged to keep our dreams and desires for our communities locked deep inside. We're told they're fantasies. We're told to get real. We're called Pollyannas. The reason I chose that as the title for my book. But it's when we connect with what we want most for our world that magic can happen. A recommitment to what's important to each of us and the ability to engage people's hearts and souls and whole beings in whatever cause we're promoting. And when that happens, catalyzing change is a whole lot easier. Which leads to questions for your own work. Are you crafting your work around what the community knows about the people living there, or are you making decisions for them? When you encounter your community's equivalent of the tribal elder Sonia spoke about, are you arguing for your organization's needs, or taking that as an opportunity to reconnect with the community's needs? How are you catalyzing your community's potential, activating their own abilities and strengths to create their own future? Are you building your programs by first asking, what strengths do community members have that we can help them activate? Are you giving your board the opportunity at every meeting to step out and talk about their own desires for their community? And if so, are you leaving that for the last item on the agenda, if there's time? Or are you making that the discussion item one, the most important item on the list? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you will share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and for our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.